The views and opinions expressed by any hosts or guests of WJMS Radio do not reflect the beliefs of its owners or associates. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to WJMS Radio or the show hosts whose words, advice, and or opinions appear from or on our website or on air.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Are we on the air?
You're listening to WJMSradio.com.
Jam.
This chick is a sick individual.
You're tuned in to Sound Off with your girl Jams right here on WJMSradio.com.
There is no competition.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Sound Off right here on WJMS Radio. This is your girl, Jams, and I'm so excited to be with you today. I have a great show for you guys. Before I get into that, some announcements to make, of course. You can follow us on social media. We're at WJMS Radio on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and Twitter. We are broadcasting live on Get Vocal right now with our WJMS Facebook page, my personal Facebook page, and on the YouTube page as well. So there's all kinds of different platforms where you can catch this conversation. You can also interact with us through all three of those platforms. I'm watching all three of them. So please feel free to comment, question, ask, or what have you, anything that you want to know about my beautiful guest that I have on for today. You can also check us out at WJMSradio.com. This episode will again broadcast on Saturday at 12 p.m. as well. So you can catch it there also. So before I get into the show, I want to thank the folks behind the scenes that make Sound Off and WJMS possible. Thank you guys for all your hard work and everything that you guys do, especially and particularly my interns. I really appreciate you guys. You guys take such a load off my shoulders, and it's wonderful having you on board. And to the folks that listen and tune in regularly and support me, thank you guys so much for all that you do. All right, so my special guest for today, you may recognize her, at least her voice, because we just started doing video within the last year or so. But you may recognize my guest. Her name is Monique Morris. She was with us several years ago when she brought out the book called Push Out, a really, really, really great book about just the education system and its flaws in terms of Black and brown girls. But Monique Morris is the co-founder of the National Black Women's Justice Institute. She's the author of several books, again, including Push Out, Black Stats, and the book that we're going to be discussing today called Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues. And her work has been featured on NPR, The New York Times, MSNBC, Essence, The Atlantic, Washington Post, Education Weekly, all that kind of stuff, including WJMS as well now. And she lives in the Bay Area with her husband and her two daughters. So, Monique, welcome back to the show. How have you been for the last 4 years?
Thank you. I've been very busy.
I see that. I am excited to catch up with you and see what's been going on since the last time we spoke. So, I guess give us a quick little overview of what's been happening since the last time we talked about Push Out.
Yeah, I think, when we first talked, Push Out was a new book, and I was really intent upon getting people to pay attention to the conditions of Black girls in schools, particularly those things that might be having a negative impact on their educational journeys. And since that time, I have visited, I haven't even counted the number of cities that I've visited, but I've visited many cities and communities across the globe talking about this issue. There have been quite a bit of community gatherings to engage in the conversation about Push Out, but also the conversations about what we do to address this issue. We now have, I partnered with Women in the Room Productions to produce a documentary film that is screening in communities across the country called Push Out, the Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. And it is based upon the book Push Out, but also the new book, Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues.
That is amazing. I saw that on the website that you have a video behind it. And I'm like, that is, yes, like we needed that so much. You know, it's so good to see some traction behind this conversation, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it is good because I do remember, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago when a small group of women would try to bring girls into the conversation about the, you know, what we were calling the school to prison pipeline and have really deep conversations about what we might do to address this issue. And people told us that we needed to wait and that girls were not a priority. And so, you know, I'm really pleased that we've moved to a space where no one can argue that girls are a priority in our community and that they deserve just as much attention as their male counterparts in combating this condition in their lives.
Yes, definitely. So for those folks that don't know, Monique Morris is the author of Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, which is her new book, which talks about structuring the education system to be more accepting and understanding of the Black and the brown girl and what's going on with the background of what they have going on in their lives. And I had the opportunity to read the book. It's really, really, really great, honestly. And, you know, to be 100% honest, as I was reading the book, I was like, well, damn, like, do we just throw the whole education system away? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you start to feel this kind of helplessness behind when you start to read just some of the issues that are going on, and just kind of, you just start to feel like overwhelmed with how much work needs to be done to revise this education system, you know? So, I mean, I guess to start out, you know, what are your opinions on where we are currently? I know you've written this book and we've sort of addressed sort of the issues, or we're talking about the issues that are listed in the book, but, you know, has progress been made in any way, shape or form yet that you've noticed? I mean, I guess since Push Out to now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when I wrote Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, I wrote it in a way that I hope invites people to understand that this is not about reforming a system, but rather reimagining what could be possible to make education responsive to the needs of Black and brown girls. Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is essentially the chronicle of what has been working in communities and in schools to respond to the issue of school pushout for Black and brown girls. I wrote the book like, you know, I wanted to pay homage to the blues giants that shape much of our understanding, and to call upon and identify the wisdom that so many of the blues women embodied and reflected in their work. And in doing so, I wrote the book, you know, really in almost like an album, where there are tracks instead of chapters and interludes. And the interludes are really edited from conversations that I've had with women who have been deeply invested in this work and have been, you know, sort of community luminaries and in shining their brilliance and working with our girls. And so I do think that there are things that we can do, and that's what I'm chronicling in the new book, are the things that have been working to transform conditions for our girls. And not just the activities, but really, you know, when I talked about push out and I started this conversation, I described push out as the policies, practices, conditions, and the prevailing consciousness that facilitates you know, a risk for our young people to be in contact with the juvenile court and criminal legal system. In Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, and particularly with the interludes and the work with women on the ground and the chronicling of what they do on the ground, you know, I've been asking folks to see this as an opportunity to do a slight deep dive on the prevailing consciousness, the idea that we can shift what we think about our girls, and that when we do that, we shift how we act.
Yeah, I agree. And I, as soon as I started reading the book, I started to see some overlap in the discussions here and the discussions that I read in Push Out, you know, like on page 22, where you talk about Black girls being more likely than other girls to be incited for dress code violations and disobedience and disruptive behavior and aggressive behavior. I remember reading that in Push Out and how you were doing sort of a description or a synopsis on how the Black girl who was being targeted for being having a dress code violation had the exact same, if not better, of a dress code than one of her, you know, white counterparts. And it was just because of the shape of her body and just the structure of how she was put together, you know, and that was what was causing sort of this quote unquote violation, you know, things that you can't necessarily control. And to be called out on something like that, that is something that's out of your control, is very damaging. Can you talk a little bit about how these kinds of things can create hostile learning environments for girls of color?
Yeah, I mean, in Push Out, I talked about the ways in which historical tropes and ideas about Black femininity, as it plays out in girlhood and womanhood, play into how we interact with them as potential scholars. And in Push Out, the discussion was about how in the enforcement of some of the dress codes, Black girl bodies are being read and policed in a way that renders them vulnerable to associations of being hypersexual, you know, triggering them if they are survivors of sexual violence, having adults, you know, sort of surveil their bodies in ways that really do in many ways perpetuate rape culture rather than emphasize the things that we hope are being emphasized in our learning spaces. In Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, what I'm trying to do is demonstrate that when schools engage in anti-oppressive structure and really try to advance ideas that are conscious of and responsive to the potential traumas in a girl's life, including those that might have been incidents in recent years or historical traumas. They're able to engage our girls much more authentically and really engage and set the foundation for there to be a rigorous interaction with them as scholars. The one thing that I hope people take from Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is that when young people don't feel safe, they engage in behaviors that are unsafe. But when young people feel safe, you know, they're able to learn. And so the emphasis in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, Education for the Liberation of Black and Brown Girls, it is really about facilitating the place of school as a location for healing. That's something that I said in a recent TED Talk that I gave. I said that schools need to become locations for healing so that they can become locations for learning. And in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, I wanted to illustrate what that might
definitely
look like.
And some of the ways that you sort of illustrate that is by talking about this idea of exclusionary discipline and suspensions and things like that. And you talk about, you know, schools sort of targeting girls of color and not offering them alternatives to suspension, you know, around somewhere age 26. Even when, you know, they may have alternatives to suspension, when they may have different things that they can, you know, employ rather than just sending the girl home or taking them out of school. You know, it to me, I thought that that was, number one, it was alarming that you would, because you just never think that schools have other things in their toolkit, if you will, besides suspension. Like, it's always the first thing people think whenever you get in trouble: suspension, detention. It's just removal from that spot, you know. And in terms of creating a culture of healing in a school, that's not how you do it. So can you talk a little bit about, I know it's hard to say, can you talk a little bit about exclusionary discipline? Because much of, but if you can sort of give the folks that haven't had a chance to read your book, sort of a synopsis on what exclusionary discipline is and sort of some of the background of why it can create, you know, an environment that's not conducive to healing, that would be good.
So exclusionary discipline refers to the actions or the reprimands in place right now that remove young people from an environment or that impact their access to instruction time in response to a behavior. So the suspensions in school and out of school, the expulsions, referrals to law enforcement, arrests on campus, corporal punishment, restraints, those are all forms of exclusionary discipline. And what the research has been telling us for the past several years is that Black girls and a rising number of brown girls are experiencing exclusionary discipline at rates that far surpass their white counterparts. And not only are they experiencing an overrepresentation, particularly among Black girls, who are the only group of girls who experience an overrepresentation along the school discipline continuum at every educational level. So in all the categories that I just named, Black girls are overrepresented. And this happens from pre-K all the way through high school. So we're not seeing, you know, that we're not saying that other girls do not experience these things. They do. But what we're saying is that we see an overrepresentation of Black girls among those who are experiencing these things. And the studies that have been done looking at why this is occurring is showing that Black girls are experiencing exclusionary discipline in association with a couple of different things. One is that they are being treated more harshly for similar offenses, if you will, to their white counterparts, where, you know, and some of these things that are considered offenses are minor infractions that are not necessarily, you know, placing them as a threat to the safety of the school, but rather, you know, sort of responding to them as annoyances or responding to them as being disruptive and then immediately removing them from the classroom. So they're receiving a harsher punishment for activities, some of which are just normal adolescent behaviors and some of which have been codified through disturbing schools laws as violations simply because our schools have not implemented the full continuum of responses. We've also seen a growing number of citations and associated with those schools that do have law enforcement present and where policing has become the dominant and first response to, in some cases, what is normal adolescent behaviors, some of which are problematic, some of which have, you know, better interventions. than calling someone in and placing them in handcuffs. We saw recently a six-year-old girl in Florida was tantrum in her class. And if you remember, there was a similar incident that I talked about in Push Out several years ago. You know, our tendency is to see these as isolated incidents, but what I'm arguing is that these are actually part of a pattern of violence that our girls are experiencing in schools, and we know that there's a better way. So the invitation in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is for us to understand that that building out these exclusionary practices is really rooted in a politics of fear, where we have essentially embraced the idea that in order for us to correct behaviors of young people, we have to take them away, put them away, get them out of the community, and that is somehow going to make them come to their senses and come back to school ready to learn. And my argument is that when young people are acting out in school, it's typically associated with something else that's going on, a certain kind of trauma or disruption in their lives. And so the idea that we can take them and put them away and that they'll come back fine it doesn't make sense to me. And it is something that has not been associated with any of the best practices in this work with young people. When we look at what actually does work with young people, we recognize that when you respond to those disruptions in a child's life, when you build out a community that can embrace that young person, tell them that they are a part of our community and valued in our community, that's when they're able to understand that their educators and the adults in their lives have empathy, and they're able to build the kinds of relationships that sustain positive youth behavior. I think what I say essentially is that when young people get in trouble, we shouldn't be pushing them away. Yeah. We should bring them in closer. And so in the bringing them in closer, that requires us to, I think what I say in the book is to suspend exclusionary discipline. And if we're going to suspend anything, suspend that. And let's think about what is going on in the brains of young people, what is going on in the lives of young people, what is going on emotionally with young people, and what's going on with the structures of our learning spaces, such that we can provide the kind of learning space that we know people need in order to be the scholars we know they can be.
Yeah, I agree. And it's funny that you say, you know, bring them in closer, you know, instead of suspending or bringing them out of the school. I've seen so many stories, and you're starting to see these stories circulate around social media and just news in general, of like these schools that are progressive, that are now creating meditation rooms for students as opposed to suspensions, or they're creating, you know, quiet areas for students to go to, you know, instead of doing X, Y, and Z. And it's just like, all of this stuff should not be, you know, news, to be honest with you.
Shouldn't be that radical.
A novel idea. Like, that to me seems like crazy. That's like, wow, this is such a great new idea. Is it? Like, why is this a new idea? You know?
So it's actually not a new idea, you know, and it's new to those maybe who came to education sort of post, you know, the gun-free schools era. Yeah. And you know, the space where folks thought that you only respond to young people's negative behavior through an aggressive form of policing. You know, educators that I have spoken with, administrators and folks who have been in education for a very long time have long understood that the most effective way to engage young people is through relationships and responding to them as humans, as whole humans. And that just isolating a behavior and then instituting a practice of removing those young people from the space really is not a reflection of the love and care that we know can actually transform lives and do what most teachers set out to do, which is to create a learning space so that they can transfer the knowledge they have to a group of young people who will take that information and grow. I've long said that I think most educators get into this profession because they believe in the promise of children. But along the way, we start to lose our capacity to really engage young people who may be experiencing forms of trauma that we don't feel equipped to respond to, or we don't get the necessary kind of training and support in our learning spaces to really increase the capacity of those educators to be the first responder or the most effective first responders that we know they already are asked to be. And so with girls and particularly those girls who are experiencing exclusionary discipline the most, or who are at the highest risk of exclusionary discipline, these are girls that often do experience the transgenerational, very complex traumas that inform how they are responding to certain triggers in their learning space. And so in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, you know, my invitation is for us to think about behaviors as symptoms of something else that's going on, and to really engage young people in those practices that shouldn't be that radical, in the practice around understanding who they are, building out the relationships, exploring what it might look like to have a learning space that does invite a young person to use mindfulness and breathing instead of saying, get out of my classroom, there's no space for you. To really try to facilitate conversations and personal healing so that there can be the kind of community healing in place in a school when a young person has a conflict and they recognize that having a conflict, it may be part of the normal human experience, but you know, trying to harm someone physically and or be removed from society if you have made a mistake shouldn't be a normal part of how we resolve conflict, because that just leads to greater conflict. And so, you know, these are you know, ways in which I think the schools can be reminded of what their primary goal should be, so that they are not the locations of punishment that they have come to be, especially, you know, in association with what young people are understanding school to be. You know, fundamentally, I want schools to be places. I want to go and talk to young people about their learning experiences and not have them describe their schools as little jails, or to say it feels like a jail. If young people are growing up in spaces where they are expected to learn, they can't feel like jails, because those are not healing spaces and safe spaces for people to fully explore who they are. They have to be a part of a different narrative. And so that's what, you know, that's what Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is trying to illustrate, is what could that narrative be? How can we see schools as something else for our girls? And what do our girls tell us they need and want? And let's do that.
So I got to ask you a question, and it's a question that's sort of rooted in today. You know, it's because it's, we obviously, you see all the violence that's happening in schools with these guns that are coming in. And you talked a little bit about the gun-free schools earlier there for a second. But with all this violence that's happening in these schools, and with everybody pushing to do everything except control the guns that are coming into these schools, how do you feel about, because in the book, you also talk about this idea of removing that surveillance aspect of the school away, you know, which I think facilitates this idea of girls thinking it's a jail. But you talk about removing that surveillance, you know, and getting rid of that, that whole idea of like being under this watchful, you know, security guard or what have you. How does that play a part, or, you know, how do you feel about that given this situation with all the violence happening in schools? You know, like if they're not moving much towards gun control at this stage of the game, so does it make logical sense for us to remove a sense of security in the schools for these children? Or, you know, I just want to get your thoughts on that, I guess.
Well, I think, you know, having police in schools and security in schools that are armed assumes that young people feel safe with them there. And we have, you know, had a number of studies demonstrate that young people don't necessarily feel safer with police patrolling their hallways, particularly Black and brown kids who have not fully reconciled their relationships with law enforcement in community. For some of them, it's actually triggering to have law enforcement in their learning space. And it actually facilitates the space where they feel even less safe in their school environment, because it feels like an extension of the surveillance they feel in many of their communities. You know, I do believe we have to have a deep conversation about gun control in this society. But I'm also clear that the young people who bring violence into schools are young people who have not had positive relationships with the adults and children in those schools. And so when we think about how we build out conditions of safety, and this is something that we hear over and over again from young people who might say, you know, there was somebody who tried to bring that kind of harm into our space, but, you know, that's because that person was a loner, that person was excluded from this environment or that environment, that they didn't have the deep connections that we know can facilitate, you know, a kind of safety that we know our young people need in order to learn. I do think it's important for schools to have a relationship with law enforcement in communities, to the extent that law enforcement is doing law enforcement work out in community. I think that's very different than having armed guards and armed teachers in schools. And that's where we have to be careful about is that much of the extension of this militarization of our learning spaces, it stifles their ability to fully engage as scholars. And let's be clear, not all schools have this kind of infrastructure. So while we talk about this as an evolving norm, we also have to be very clear that in the schools that are predominantly populated by white students, we don't tend to see this kind of surveillance. And when the police are there, they actually do something different. So when the police, you know, I include this a bit in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, is that part of the problem here is that, you know, there's so much discretion in law enforcement in how they act, how they engage, both with the school and with the students, that, you know, creating a condition of safety with the idea that by bringing something external or some external force into the space, it just doesn't make sense to me that you know, really ultimately what we're trying to do is create a structure of safety that is facilitative of emotional safety, physical safety, and not a conditional safety that, you know, really relies on the presence of weapons. If our idea is to make this a weapon-free environment, then we have to make it a weapon-free environment. And we have to increase our capacity to build out the relationships that really do sustain safety the way that young people describe it to be, and that provide educators with the tools they need to effectively manage their learning spaces. That means that when a young person acts out, I don't necessarily call law enforcement in to say this person is not responding to my question, or I've asked the student to leave. Now we need to call the police to get them out of here. We say this child is not behaving in a way that feels fine to me. I've already set up a set of classroom agreements that say that if we're having a rough day, then maybe we can use a nonviolent way of asking that child to reexamine what they might need, or that adolescent, you know, to reexamine what they might need to be present in the classroom. This is something that we do at the higher educational levels, and I don't understand why we can't do it at the earlier age and instructional
levels as
well.
I feel like they just don't think kids can articulate what they really need. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like they just assume that younger kids are like, oh, you don't know because you're a kid. But kids will tell you very well, you know, what is needed to, like, if you sit down with a kid and say, hey, how do you feel? They'll give you, you know, an entire story about how they feel. They'll tell you. You just have to listen and listen for.
No, that's right. That's right. And, you know, some of the safest spaces that I have been in, the safest schools that I have been in, have been those schools where at the very beginning of the school year, educators are co-constructing their classroom rules together, where they are talking about what they might need. They ask the students what they want. Girls for Gender Equity released a tremendously helpful report a few years ago called The Schools Girls Deserve. That was a participatory project led by young people in New York City who all listed out what they wanted to experience in their schools. And it included cisgender, transgender girls, non-binary youth, all saying, this is what I need to feel safe.
Yeah.
They were very clear about it. It was an effective document. And so I think, you know, this idea that young people don't know what they want, you can ask a kindergartner what she wants and she'll tell you what she needs in that moment. It's about making sure that there's an infrastructure in schools to respond to that. Let's have counselors in the space. Let's have practitioners in the space. Let's make sure the modalities that we engage in our instructional models are allowing young people to move their bodies as a form of expression and learning. Let's do the work of education, not the work of policing.
And it's funny
and
because it's funny you mentioned that, because they've done so many budget cuts, quote unquote, recently, that they've cut counselors, they've cut, you know, the arts and things like that, these outlets of expression that these children had to really talk about and to really vent out these situations and stuff. They've removed all of those outlets for kids. And you wonder why everybody's acting out and why things are happening. You know, you take out the outlets for people to respond, and that's what happens. You know, they have no other place to react but in the space that they're in.
Listen, when I was, you know, when I gave my TED Talk, I started the TED Talk with a story of a fight that I got into in the sixth grade. And it was a fight with a boy who had been bothering me, and I just had enough one day. And so we fought, and it was, you know, all the educators responded to me with empathy because they realized that it was something that they didn't want to turn into a bigger thing. They didn't remove me from school. They didn't suspend me. They sat me down and they were like, Monique, what happened? Right? They were clear about the fact that they knew who I was. So first of all, they knew me. they knew my name. They knew, you know, that I was somebody that they, you know, that didn't usually or need to, you know, have this kind of intervention. And so they talked to me about what happened. It turns out that, yeah, I was a victim of sexual violence, and I was working through that and working through that anger using the tools that I had available to me that day, which unfortunately was my body in a violent way. And, you know, I think about that. And then I think about the years that followed that altercation in class and how I spent probably 6 months out because I was reading and so advanced in school that I would spend a lot of time doing art. I did the mural in the school. I would go out and do portraits. And the educators did not punish that at all. They would say, you finished your work, go ahead and draw. So it was a motivation for me, right? Like, let me finish my work so I can go draw, right? And the engagement of the arts, the engagement of sports, all those things are healing practices that for some reason we try to think of as extracurricular, but they're really healing strategies in our schools. And we knew this. And so, you know, part of what I'm trying to do is remind people of what we already know. Restorative practices is an old engagement strategy of building relationships and resolving conflict by understanding harm and resolving harm. So we call these new practices, but they're really quite old. When we think about participatory engagement, we say these are new emergent fields of study and engagement. But I'm like, we've always told stories as a part of how we understand certain things. We just have to be reminded of who we are. It's something that I tell young people all the time when they're going through their own transformations. We have to remind our institutions who they're supposed to be also.
Exactly. And the one thing I will say about the policing in the community, you had a section in the book where you talked about the grandmas. And I just thought that was such an awesome sort of interlude or story. For those folks that haven't read the book yet, she discusses this school that got rid of security altogether and implemented a host of grandmothers who walked the hallways and just policed them. And like she, you know, mentioned in the interlude, you hear this powerful voice in behind somebody that says, take off your hat. And the kid just takes his hat off and keeps it moving. But it's like this idea of respecting your elders and using that tradition that we all sort of have ingrained in us as a method to work with students. Like that is ingenious to me. I'm like, that is so smart. If I saw a grandmother who was like, take your hat off. Yes, ma'am. Like, take your hat off. You know, like, you don't question it. You just do what they say because they're the grandmothers, and that's what happens.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, it's an interesting thing because when I saw it, I was floored because it was so simple and yet, you know, was so transformative just to hear the grandmothers and watch them walk the youth to class. And some of them even sat in the school and sat in on the classroom learning space. And in other schools in the South that have implemented similar programs with elders who come in, they may run, you know, some of the alternative healing spaces or the nurseries that are assigned to schools. And for young people who have, you know, like mother hunger or who are longing for relationships with elders because they didn't necessarily get that kind of thing in their life, it just is amazing to watch the young people go in, and because everybody respects the grandmothers. I was like, this is brilliant. Everyone respects the grandmother. And even if they don't respect the grandmother, the peer pressure will get them to respect the grandmother.
Like,
because it's a norm. Exactly. And it's a norm that's underdeveloped and a resource in our community. One of the things that we say in the Push Out film is that when, you know, when we talk about priorities and resourcing, we have to really deeply interrogate what it is that we are elevating in this conversation. If we, you know, one of the contributors to the film, Nzinga Dugas, who is in California, said, you know, if it's a priority to a group, you'll find the money. People build stadiums if they want to attract a certain tax base. We find all the money to support law enforcement in schools and prisons. And we hear even the law enforcement officers themselves say they're under-resourced for this, you know, but our demand is that they take on these responsibilities that they're not equipped to do. They're not trained to do this. They don't go through the kinds of training and supports around early adolescent development that educators go through or early childhood specialists go through. And so they're not equipped to deal with this. And yet, and then we, you know, track, unfortunately, what happens when they respond to conditions that they're not equipped to deal with. Not, you know, college counselors only, right? Emotional, clinical psychologists, folks who can bring in healing modalities and methods into spaces. Yes, the mindfulness practices are critically important. That's something that Parkland did, is they, after that horrible tragedy, they decided to begin to engage in some other healing practices. I met with one of the teachers recently who talked about the mindfulness and the heavy belly, deep belly breaths being transformative for her students post that tragedy, because our bodies need to respond to these conditions and we have to feel safe or we will not learn. And so, you know, the invitation with Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is to be reminded of all the different ways that we can bring healing into our space, particularly in those ways that are culturally competent and relevant to Black and Brown students who do engage dance, who do engage vocal engagement, who do engage advocacy. These are all healing strategies, not affronts to authority.
And also going along with that, in, I mean, one of the themes in the book that you talk about as well is this idea of the, you know, the ACE, which is the, it's the really ACEs. Sort of the underlying theme behind a lot of the things that are going on with people is just the childhood experiences are affecting their behavior now is some of the underlying reasons why people, quote unquote, act out or misbehave. So can you, for the for the folks who haven't read, you know, page 46, you talk about 70% of girls of color in a given classroom have ACE scores of 4 or more. Can you talk a little bit about what that ACE score is and kind of how it plays a part in behavior?
Yeah. So the ACEs, the ACE stands for the Adverse Childhood Experiences, and we call them ACEs for short. And it was a study that showed that that early childhood trauma can have an impact on one's physical and emotional health. The study was popularized by Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, who is California's first Surgeon General and who is a pediatrician who has done a tremendous amount of work to get us to understand just the impact of childhood traumas and to recognize that some of the things that we've been labeling as other forms or disorders or other forms of behavioral problem or disorder are actually the brain doing what it's supposed to do when it's trying to protect someone from trauma. And so, or when it's triggered by a condition that reminds a young person of the traumas that they've had. And so, you know, the idea is that, you know, the research shows that when you have an ACE score of 4 or more, and ACEs, those childhood traumas include things, it's a scale, it's a 10-point scale, that includes things like divorce or incarcerated parent or sexual assault or poverty or some of these other things or a substance use disorder. Yep. A lot of those kinds of things that play a role in communities that when you have a score of 4 or more out of 10, that you're at a higher risk of having certain physical health conditions and illnesses, as well as it as an impact on your capacity to learn, your ability to pay attention, the ways in which you may be fidgety or not be able to sit still in class, those kinds of things. In addition to, you know, respiratory conditions or cancer or other things that plague our society. What's groundbreaking about the ACEs score and Dr. Burke-Harris's work is that it provides us with an opportunity to screen our young people and understand their behaviors as a function of something that is going on in their lives or that has happened to them, as opposed to us just writing them off as problem children or bad kids. And, you know, everyone has an ACE score, everyone. and so the issue is it may be, you know, one or, you know, and in which case, you know, you've overcome that horrible condition or that disruption in your life and you moved on because you had a certain set of resiliency factors in your life and buffers in your life, or your score may be 9, sometimes 10, if you've had extraordinary traumas and a repeated set of conditions that impacts whether you're able to respond. The invitation from Dr. Burke-Harris and from me in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is to think about how we build out spaces, classrooms, learning communities that are responsive to those traumas so that we can become the ACE buffers that we know schools have historically been, rather than places where those traumas are triggered and the pain exacerbated. I know that education has historically been an important part of how we expand opportunity in our society. And I believe that this is a fundamental educational equity issue. This is about educational justice. This is about recognizing that everyone should have access to a quality education. That should not be determined by how much money you are paying for your child's schooling, and it should not be determined by where you live. That the capacity to have these kind of ACE buffers should not be reserved only for those with financial resources to pay for it. That it should be a part of the deeply ingrained pedagogical approach to how we engage young people, because when we do that, we'll make sure that every child has access to this kind of environment, not yeah, just
and
those
related
with the money.
To that. Something that stuck out to me as well, on page 51, you talk about research showing that, you know, individuals who have some life experience with adversity have an increased capacity for empathy with others, and talking about how that plays a part in teaching. And, you know, I always yeah. like this. This is not just in teaching. This is in regular life. This is in, you know, in current situations like now. I always talk about community policing and how I think it's, you know, important to have community policing, because, you know, a person who comes from a community understands that community. They know the people in that community. They know that this person mm-hmm. has ADHD and he's going to run off. You know, that the community already respects them. Whereas somebody who's cold and doesn't know these people are automatically going to immediately think, oh, danger. Oh, you know, I'm feeling threatened, and so on and so forth. And they're going to immediately go to that response. Whereas somebody who is understanding and who's been through that and who has been in that community is going to understand a little bit more and maybe give more hesitation and more thought into the way they respond to a certain situation. The same thing goes for these teachers. You know, you have a teacher who came from the hood, quote unquote, or a teacher who's been through poverty or who's been through what you've been through and is teaching. You're going to understand when somebody's acting out in your class that maybe something you said is a trigger, or maybe a lesson that you're teaching is a trigger. You're going to understand that a little bit more, and you're going to be a little bit more empathetic to their situation instead of just saying, get out of my class. You're going to be like, okay, let's break down the root of why you're having an issue right now, you know, and what's going on. And I think that that's really important.
It is really important. It's also important to recognize that these are skills that we still have to develop, even among those who may be familiar mm-hmm. or, you know, from a community that is similar to the one that they're currently teaching in or a part of, because there's a lot of internalized oppression and a lot of ways in which we, you know, those who, you know, can say that they empathize on one issue might have also internalized some pretty harsh responses to what they feel works in response to those issues, because they have adopted the ways that are oppressive and that facilitate harm as an appropriate response. And so we talk about that a lot, because just because we talk about that in the film and I talk about it in the book, just because you're a Black teacher doesn't necessarily mean you're gonna know how to work with Black yeah. kids effectively, or that you won't cause harm to Black kids. Because you're a Latinx teacher doesn't mean that you're automatically going to be a safe haven for Latinx children, right? Like, we have to think about the ways in which we facilitate first of all, we have to be clear about the ways that oppression manifests in our society so that we can be responsive to it. So when I talk about that, you know, I typically say that, you know, oppression, we know from the science that oppression manifests in four primary ways. It manifests structurally, individually, culturally, and in internalized ways. And when we really break that down and start to attack it, in those four different domains, then we're able to do the work and begin the work around understanding ourselves so that we can recognize that relationships facilitate safety. And the more we build out relationships and the more we understand how relationships function to engage power differently, then we're able to start moving in a direction where our young people
Definitely.
Can feel safe
it's,
enough
it's
to
funny
learn.
You said that. I had a show on the station actually called Black Girls Unfiltered. And it's two college kids from NYU who just talk about life. You know, they just really have topics that are affecting them currently and affecting their peers. And they had a conversation about their expectations in college and what they thought going into college. And they were talking about how, you know, there was a lack of diversity and there was a lack of, you know, Black professionals to relate to. And the one student got on and said, you know, I have a Black teacher, but like, I still don't trust them, or I still don't feel comfortable around them, you know, and so on and so forth. And it just made me, as soon as you said that, it brought me right back to that, you know, about like, yes, you are, you have gone through these things, but let's talk about the way you cope with them. And let's talk about, you know, how you're going to present to other folks. So I thought that that was, it's just interesting because, you know, you never, and you think back in your own education, you're like, did I have a Black teacher? Like, yeah. Did I feel comfortable going to them about stuff? Maybe not. Maybe not.
But also, and I may have had a white teacher that I felt really great with and had a connection with, right? So it's about emphasizing the things yep. that and the skills, you know, that I call them skills and competencies, really, around building relationships, around really thinking through how you are understanding these young people that facilitates your capacity to build out those kinds of relationships. But we know that, you know, young people who have at least one adult on campus mm-hmm. that they can connect with have a reduced likelihood of experiencing exclusionary discipline. That just means that every student needs to have one adult on campus, one person that they trust, right? That they can go to, who can be a part of their safe space, and that they're less likely to engage in, you know, activities that will result in some kind of harsh punishment. It's, you know, it's something, again, that we should be reminded of. But also recognize that it takes time to build. You can't just say, you know, that kid is easy. I want that kid. I don't have time for this. You got to think about what it is that is the work of the teacher. And I think most educators give above and beyond the requirements to give of themselves in a way that can facilitate learning. But some of these reminders provide the space for them to be strategic in how they are applying their extra energy and time, such that we can really have the greatest impact.
And so we have about 13 minutes left in the show. Before we end, I do want to touch on mental health, because that is a big, big, big factor in a lot of this. Around page 114, you talk about, it says, not only does the absence of diagnoses prevent treatment and appropriate institutional response, but also the biases that inform interactions with these students foster a lack of patience among the adults who respond to the negative yeah. behaviors with punishment rather than care. You know, in the Black right. community, we are very much underdiagnosed. You know, there's such a stigma around mental yeah. health in our community that it's insane to me, because there's really nothing wrong with going to seek help. There's really nothing wrong with talking to somebody. There's nothing wrong mm-hmm. with getting a diagnosis. Literally, you know, duct tape and Windex don't fix everything. You know, like, you can't just drink ginger ale and lay down for some of these issues. Right. So for, yeah, right. I think a lot of the onus needs to be on us as a community to get rid of some of that stigma around mental health and make it okay to talk about what's going on with you, so that people feel comfortable getting that diagnosis. And then on the flip side, not only do we have to do that, we then need to take, you know, sort of the steps to get educators who are equipped to deal with that, you know, who don't necessarily write it off, or who don't just, you know, trigger it even more. People who understand what's going on with this diagnosis and how it plays a factor in the education that these students are getting. So it's just a really complicated issue. I really think that the first steps of that issue comes from us as people to stop putting such a stigma on mental health. We need to talk about it. We need to have conversations and normalize having mental check-ins with yourself to say, am I okay? Am I going through something? Am I responding to something? Am I getting triggered by things I shouldn't be getting triggered by? And so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, it's really important to focus on the health. It's one of the reasons I, you know, wanted to anchor this conversation about recovery and transformation in the blues tradition. Because the one thing we know is that blues women used to speak a truth that sometimes wasn't easy for folks to deal with. And while they also talked about their coping mechanisms to some of these conditions, they were very open. And I think in many ways provided a platform for there to be the kind of truth telling that we've shied away from in some of our practices. But that does a disservice to us in our efforts to try to bring a space where we can talk about a host of issues that are part of the, you know, we call it the Vegas mentality, the what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, what happens in my house stays in my house, right? And so it's really important to think about what kind of harm that does to individuals who cannot heal when we try to keep things in and try not to be vocal, which is why I position in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, I position advocacy yeah. as a healing strategy, because it has long been a part of the you know, tradition of folks who have experienced chronic exploitation and violence in their home communities to speak up and speak out. And I talked about in Push Out how Black girls, you know, are responded to when they try to engage this strategy, but you know, the invitation is to, instead of trying to shut Black girls down when they speak up and speak out, embrace this as a way of knowing and understand that when we anchor our educational practices and healing practices in a tradition of one being able to speak truth to power, that not only is there a reconciliation with the historical traumas that have undermined opportunity in our communities, there's a personal healing and transformation that can occur too, to create conditions that facilitate health, wellness, and safety.
Anthony Davis checks in here on Get Vocal and says, I think a lot of mental health issues are caused by health issues that cause chemical imbalances, i.e. diabetes, cancer, and cerebral palsy. Yeah. There's always an argument to be made for, you know, food that we eat, and for air that we're breathing, for situations that we're in, whether it's stress related and so on and so forth. But it's also about how you respond to those things. You know, it's about how do we as educators educate students dealing with those things, and how do we do it in a way that doesn't cause more harm and facilitates more of a healing situation? You know, so there's definitely conversation to be had around some of the things that cause these mental health issues for sure.
Here's the thing. There's a tapestry of harm in our lives. I want schools to be part of the tapestry of healing. You can be a part of the tapestry of harm, or you can be a part of the of this community of healing. And so, you know, the invitation is for us to think about our intention. If our intention is to be part of the tapestry of harm, then we'll ignore the mental health conditions, the mental health issues and conditions that, you know, facilitate a lot of what's going on. There will be the opportunity for there to be this lack of diagnoses and sort of marginalizing of those young people who are greatest in need. But if we want to be a part of the tapestry of healing, if we want to set the intention to have schools be what we know they can be, so that we do not have this kind of overrepresentation of our girls in conditions of harm, and we can reduce the number of boys who are experiencing conditions of harm and non-binary youth who are experiencing conditions of harm, then we will set our intentions and align our policies, practices, et cetera, to do just that. And so, you know, the way that I see it, and the way that I think most people see it, is these are conditions. Some of these conditions are really big, and some of them are too big for one person to address. But these issues are created by our neglect in a host of different ways: neglect of the planet, neglect of our home communities, and a neglect of our emotional well-being, so that we understand that in many ways, our joy, our wellness, these are acts of resistance. And we have to be very clear about that in a society where the politics of fear dominate discussions about how we respond to young people. And so I agree, Jamie, and I agree, you know, that we should think about the issues that Anthony is raising as opportunities to position ourselves along this space. Are we going to be part of the tapestry of healing, or are we going to be part of the tapestry of harm?
I definitely agree. And I like that. I like that you created that, those two sort of paths to be on, one or the other. You know, I like that's, can we do that though? I wonder. I do have another question.
I think you can.
Another listener has a question. I'm going to get to that question in a second. Before we do, I do want to mention one more image in that book that really made me just sigh with, just made my heart happy. At the end of the book, you talk about the city council member who held a double Dutch tournament to be sort of like as a healing and educational equity event for girls. And you talked about just the double Dutch event itself and like all the stuff that went into it and all the people that were participating and the rhythm of the ropes and everything else. And I just remember reading that and being like, oh, like it just brought me back to my childhood. It made my heart so happy to think about that. And I was just like, we really need to find a way to bring back double Dutch some way.
Two things. So I happen to be wearing today this shirt, Justice for Black Girls. It is a conference that took place mm-hmm. in Harlem this weekend. And they had a double Dutch interlude because it was a natural thing that girls are going to do if they find some rope that's long enough to turn. So they did that along with talking about ways of facilitating healing for Black girls and being ambassadors for justice in a way that we know that Black girls can be, should be, and the way that adults should be for them also and with them. So that council member became Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. And the Congresswoman has herself as a leader in the space around girls. The premiere, the world premiere of our Push Out documentary was held at the Congressional Black Caucus this year with her hosting it. And she announced that she's working on federal legislation to begin to address some of these conditions around Push Out and girls of color. So stay tuned for that. But I think having a connection with oneself, understanding who you are, understanding what facilitates healing and safety can provide you with a grounding to be able to engage in conversations about justice differently. One of my favorite quotes is from Dr. King, who said, justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. And when we think about the usage of our power to advance the politics, if you will, and practice of love, as opposed to fear, there's infinite possibility.
Well, we do have one more question. I don't know if we have time to necessarily address it. I will present this question to you under the guidance that you still need to give your contact information. So structure your answer appropriately. Okay. So the person that messaged me just asked if, you know, it all seems to be a lot to take in. And if there are any like low hanging fruits or small steps that educators can start to do or start to implement in their classrooms or in their schools that can make a positive difference. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree that these are big issues that we were talking about today. But part of what I'm demonstrating in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is that much of this can be addressed in small, discrete, practical ways in the classroom. And I give examples about that in the book. I do think what we also want to demonstrate is that when we're engaging in conversations about measurable progress, when we're talking about ways of responding with empathy, that these feel like large concepts, but they're actually operational. You can operationalize these in a host of different ways, as long as one is clear about the critical questions that they might begin to ask about how to structure a curriculum, how to engage in the foundations for this kinds of transformation that we're inviting in this conversation. With Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, and Push Out, the books are available wherever books are sold, but you can certainly get information about them from my website, MoniqueWMorris.me. The Push Out film also has a host of recommendations and strategies associated with engaging in a response to that work. And all of that can be accessed through pushoutfilm.com. There are study guides, discussion guides, other resources that we've prepared for educators and others who want to be a part of this conversation. So find us online at pushoutfilm.com or follow us on social media and with the number of screenings and discussions we're having in local communities at Push Out Film. And, you know, certainly pick up the books because they do. I wrote them so that they could be easily digested by folks, but particularly educators with Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, to ensure that there are some real practical applications for some of these bigger concepts that we're discussing.
Excellent. I hope that answers your question. And you definitely gave your contact information also, which is great. Is there anything else coming up on the horizon that we should know about, any events or anything like that, or anything else you want to share with the audience before we close for the day?
Yeah, I mean, again, we have several other screenings for the Push Out documentary where we have panel discussions and opportunities to engage in conversation around these issues happening. So visit pushoutfilm.com or my website to see where I'll be. I won't be at every screening. I cannot do that. We have more than 200 happening this fall in communities. But they should be rigorous community discussions about how we support and stand with our girls. So connect with us. This is a movement. We're there. Our girls are sacred
and
loved.
I'm so glad to see so much traction and so much movement behind you since the last time I spoke. I'm so excited to see just how amazing this has all become. You know, it's really taken on a life of its own. I'm really happy for you. I'm excited for you.
Of course. Thanks, Judy.
Time to be with me today. I am wrapping it up at exactly 1 hour because I know you have other things to do today. But thank you so much for being with me. I'll be back again next week with a brand new episode. So make sure you guys keep it locked. This Sunday is the Lung Cancer Walk out here in Brooklyn, New York. Money that you raise goes to folks like me who are fighting lung cancer currently and anybody who's affected by it. So please feel free to donate. I think I'm like $500 away from my goal. So anybody watching right now, if you could spare anything, that would be great. But in the meantime, I will catch everybody next week. Be safe, be blessed. And again, Monique, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Every day I wake and everything is broken. Turning off my phone just to get out of bed. Get home every evening and history's repeating. Turning off my phone 'cause it's hurting my chest. Yeah. And heaven knows I'm not helpless. Yeah. But what can I do? Can't sit and hope, I can't just sit and pray that I can find a love when all I see is pain. Falling to my knees, and though I do believe, I can't just preach, baby, preach. Oh, 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 I can't just preach, baby. All I hear is voices, everybody's talking. Nothing real is happening, 'cause nothing is new. Now when all is tragic, and I just feel sedated, why do I feel numb? Is that all I can do? Yeah. And heaven knows I'm not helpless. Yeah. But I'm only human. Can't sit and hope, I can't just sit and pray that I can find a love when all I see is pain. I'm falling to my knees, and though I do believe, I can't just preach, baby, preach. Oh, oh, I can't just preach, baby, preach. Can't sit and hope, I can't just sit and pray that I can find a love when all I see is pain. I try to do the things I say that I believe. I can't just preach, baby, preach. Oh, 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 I can't just preach.
Thanks for listening. Tune in 24/7 at WJMSradio.com.